You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything. Today's episode is brought to you guys by Squarespace, which is actually an excellent company, and I'll tell you why. They make it very easy to create your own website. And it used to be, I know I spent a lot of money getting a website done. It was a very difficult thing to do. I've had people send me examples of what they do with their Squarespace, and it's pretty impressive. It looks as good as any website I've seen. And they've got this great support staff. Apparently, they're available 24/7. So if you have any problems, they can walk you through it. But I've heard from a lot of people that they didn't even need to call the customer support. And the good news is, if you go to squarespace.com/Brian Callen and put in the promo code Callen11, you get 10% off. You see the kind of pull and power I have? It's amazing. But the good news, I guess they're always improving their platform. They've got new features, new designs. They're always cutting edge. Starts at $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience, and it matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on any device all the time. It also integrates audio blocks to post your stand-up routines, shows, and podcasts, which is great for a comic or even a musician. Once again, if you're thinking about selling merchandise like MP3s or anything else, Squarespace allows you to sell anything with, they have an e-commerce feature. So this is what I say. You can start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code, once again, Callen11. So go to squarespace.com/Brian Callen, promo code Callen11, get 10% off. So thank you, Squarespace, for making me feel so important. Guys, I'm going to be at Wise Guys November 29th and 30th. That is in Salt Lake City, the 29th and 30th. I will be at Wise Guys. I hear great things about the club from Joey Diaz and from Steve-O. So I'm very much excited about that. So come on out and I will make you laugh. I'll be at Helium in Philadelphia, December 12th, 13th, and 14th. And then I'll be at the Improv in Tempe, Arizona. Gee, I wonder if that'll be fun. Can't wait. The 19th, 20th, and 21st of December. So I expect to see all of you out there. I expect you to be breaking the door. I expect lines around the block. I expect you to get no sleep because you waited in line all night the way they used to do for Springsteen concerts in the 80s. Is that too much to ask? Thank you. And now on to the show, ladies and gentlemen. All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show with my... This is Brian Callen Show, Hunter Motz. And I always just whisper his name, even though he basically, you know, gets all these incredible guests. And speaking of incredible guests and an incredible book, I just read this book, The Merchants of Doubt. Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway are the authors with us now. You guys, listen, I am one of those people. I've always been a free market guy. I always boast about being a libertarian. I go to the Cato Institute, and I go to their
or at least the website.
Yeah, the website. And I'm always talking about this. And by the way, before your book, I have to say that I did think that the science about global warming and even the ozone layer. I remember this. I remember it went away. Acid rain. I was up in the Northeast. I was going to high school up there. And I was always kind of, until your book, I kind of was like, well, you know, it's a debatable science. And you guys did such an amazing job of showing that, in fact, a small group of scientists, and I'm speaking specifically of, say, Fred Singer and Frederick Seitz and I can't remember the other guys.
Bill Nirenberg.
Yes. We're really not only corporate shills, in my opinion, but also we're fighting not about science, but really an ideology. We're so ideologically opposed to any kind of government regulation to our detriment. And I think you do such an amazing job of bringing that to light. So thank you for opening my eyes.
Naomi, you wrote all the sections on the tobacco science. I think that's a good place for us to start off, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, one of the reasons this book got started was because I was doing work on climate change, climate science, and as Brian just said, had really realized that there was very little scientific debate about the basic essential elements of the climate change story, but yet, nonetheless, many people, like Brian and many others, had the impression it was a big scientific debate, and that impression was being generated by a small handful of scientists, like Fred Singer, Fred Seitz, Bill Nirenberg, who weren't even really climate scientists, and who had really, I would say, in a way, kind of distorted the public debate about the issue. And I was talking about this at a conference where I met Eric, and Eric came up to me afterwards and said, well, Naomi, do you realize that these are the same guys who denied the science related to ozone depletion, the ozone hole? And I said, really?
Yeah.
So Eric gets the credit for making that first connection. And when he did, then I started digging a little deeper. And then that's when I found the connection to the tobacco story. And at that point, I picked up the phone and said to Eric, Eric, we have to write a book. Because what we discovered was that these same people had not just denied the scientific evidence related to the ozone hole and had not just denied the scientific consensus related to acid rain, but actually had denied the scientific evidence related to the harms of tobacco. And that seemed to us to be a pretty shocking story.
Well, it also bears repeating that both Fred Singer and Frederick Seitz were nuclear physicists. They weren't even biologists. They didn't have a background in this stuff.
Right. Well, that's in a way where the story began for me, because I was aware of that. I knew who these people were, particularly Fred Seitz, who was a very, very famous physicist, a solid-state physicist, whose work was well known to me and to Eric because of his role as an important physicist in the 20th century, and also his role as the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. So a very well-known, very prominent, and very respected physicist, but not a climate scientist, and definitely not a doctor or an oncologist or a cancer researcher.
Right.
So when we saw these guys, physicists, but pronouncing, making very, very bold and strong claims about areas way outside of their scientific expertise, that's when we began to realize that there was something more to the story than simply an honest scientific debate.
Wow. Yeah, Eric. Well, we'll keep going with this, because and you do a very good job of, it's very easy to sort of demonize these people. You know, Singer does not come across looking so great in this book, and probably shouldn't, man. I mean, he feels like a guy who at one time had his heyday as a physicist and then just became a publicity hound. But that's, you know, look, that whatever that is, I also think that you do a good job of at least providing, you say, you know, what's really going on here? And it really does feel like a case of ideology, political ideology. And a political ideology, by the way, that I talk about and I actually support for the most part. And that's why the book is so important for people like me. You know, I love to talk about what a libertarian I am and a free market guy and how I love individual liberty. But you also make a really interesting point in the book, which is you cite, I can't remember who, he was a philosopher. Oh, why am I forgetting his name? But anyways, he said, you know, yes, liberty. If you can grant wolves liberty until they start eating sheep or something to that extent. Right. You have the freedom to throw
Berlin.
A punch. What, say again, what is it? Who is it?
It's Isaiah Berlin.
Isaiah Berlin, right. And that, exactly. You can throw a punch, but your freedom ends at my nose. You know, and the fact of the matter is we live in an increasingly codependent world, and you know, here's my question to you guys. Here's my question. You know, when I read about, for example, the tobacco debate, when we knew really most scientists, and so did the people selling these cigarettes, they really did know. If you look at their internal memos and things, they knew that cigarettes were killing people as early as 1960. I don't know. You know, I do this podcast and I have sponsors, and I was talking about how there's no way I'm ever going to let Coca-Cola come to me with $1 million. I'm saying no because I don't believe in their product. I just don't know how people can live with themselves. I really don't know how you can pay your mortgage. I don't know how you can do it when you know you're selling poison. Can you, what is your take when you come away from the chairman of RJR, you know, whatever.
RJ Reynolds.
RJ Reynolds and Benson and Hedges and these. What were these people thinking? Are these bad people? Are they sociopaths? What was really going on here, man? Do you come away cynical? Because I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated question. I suppose the bottom line is you'd have to have a different radio show and invite those people and talk to them. I mean, we can't really speak for what's going on in their minds. Yeah. But the feeling I had when we were writing the book was the one you just said. I don't know how these people sleep at night. I don't know how they can justify selling a product that they know is deadly, that they know is killing people. But, you know, one of the things that I think we tried to bring out in the book, well, two things really. First of all, the driving force of ideology, the driving force of this commitment to the idea of the free market that then trumps every other consideration. Yeah. And I think Eric and I both agree with you. I mean, I used to call myself a left-wing libertarian because I don't really want the government telling me what to do either. I don't think anybody really does.
Right.
But the question is, does that basic concept trump everything else? Does it trump other considerations? And does it trump the facts? And so what we see in this story are people who are so wedded to that ideology that it trumps the facts. Well, so they convince themselves, at least in the case of climate change, but I think for some of the tobacco executives too, they persuade themselves of their own story. They persuade themselves that the science isn't really certain. And therefore, if it's not certain, then they can go to bed at night because then it's not proven that their product is killing people. Now, in the case of tobacco, of course, we know that it really was proven. But these other issues, you know, last a long time because in the case of things like ozone and acid rain and global warming, you know, for a long time, they weren't really proven. There was evidence. There was strong evidence. The evidence became stronger over time. And eventually it got to a point where scientists were saying, yes, we know that this is true. But during that interim, during that middle ground, it was fairly easy for people to say to themselves, well, we're not really sure, and therefore we can keep doing what we're doing.
They sell the same doubt. They swallow the same doubt that they're selling to all of us, in other words.
Exactly. They believe their professors.
You know, and it reminds me of the Upton Sinclair quote. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it.
You know? Well, I can see how, you know, look, I think drugs should probably be legal. I'm a believer. And if you're stupid enough to do a lot of meth, look, I'll tax you and I'll sequester you somewhere. But I mean, if you want to do a lot of blow, my experience is when you do a lot of blow, things don't work out for you. But if you want to make that choice, go ahead. At least maybe the cartels will crumble and people won't be killing themselves in Mexico for a habit we have in this country. I understand that debate. So, but when you're specifically selling it, when you're manipulating levels of nicotine that you know is not only very addictive and toxic, it's really opened my eyes to the fact that I live in a town that's fairly cynical and fairly left-wing and is always saying, well, corporate people are bad or, you know, and I always say, look, it's way more complicated. And it is way more complicated. But I have to say that reading your book, it's very hard not to come away not only very cynical, but also very skeptical of any, you know, we live in a society where it seems like these big corporations will do almost anything to protect their bottom line. And I do think there are very, very ethical companies out there. IBM is very, very conscientious. I just read an article about them. And I think that we live in a very transparent, more and more of a transparent world. So I think there are very responsible corporations out there. So I don't want to, I'm not saying corporations are the bad guy. Do you think that things are getting better? Do you think it's becoming harder to hide the truth? Or I mean, your book would suggest maybe not, especially not when it comes to global warming. And I want to talk to Eric about that.
Oh, my. I guess what question are you asking me?
I like asking a lot of questions. I like playing. Yeah, I like shotgunning a lot. I'm not an intellectual. I just ask questions.
Why? No. Why?
Yeah. Is it harder to in areas that are kind of well understood scientifically? Yeah, it's getting harder and harder to hide the truth. But one of the realities of industrial capitalism, right, is they're always making new products, and so it can you hide the problems in new products for quite a long time? I think the answer to that is still yes, because we haven't put into place the sorts of regulatory needs to disclose information and so on. So, for example, one of the things that's not in the book is that we don't require toxicity testing of industrial chemicals prior to them going on the market. We only require that if companies do the testing, they have to disclose it. So the answer is they don't do the testing.
Wow.
All right?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't know that.
But we require toxicity testing of pharmaceuticals, but not of industrial chemicals.
Wow.
And so that's what I mean. There are these regulatory gaps that prevent us from knowing right away whether a new product is likely to be bad or not. And that's one of the cases where this kind of libertarian ideal falls down, because you can't make, and we talk about this in the book, you can't make good societal decisions without good information.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you also make a good point and a good argument in the book for when the government actually does come in and set regulations that are fairly strident, industry innovates and meets those challenges fairly well.
Oh, yes. That's actually that's one of the big success stories that, again, we couldn't really tell in Merchants of Doubt, but it's a fantastic one about cars, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Once they established emission standards, you know, the Japanese figured out how to meet them very efficiently, and one of Detroit's problems was that they kind of went in denial for a while, and they kind of got their pants beat for a decade or 15 years before they themselves came around and then figured out how to do it well. And now most cars greatly exceed the emissions requirements most of the time.
Right.
And that's a huge success story, and just goes to show what powers of well-crafted regulation can actually accomplish.
So Eric, you've done a lot of the research. You certainly looked at a lot of the research for this book, and as well, so you as well, Naomi. Is global warming, I mean, is this, should I go start making a boat?
Well, I live in Pasadena, California, and so we're about 600 feet above sea level, so I'm in no real danger.
There you go.
That's 1,000 years worth of glacier melting to get to me, and even then, I think they can't quite get to me.
All right, good.
But the low leveling, very low lying places below a meter, yeah, it's going to be a problem, because we're reaching the point, I don't know that we're there yet, that much sea level rise becomes unavoidable. And that's going to cost nations of the world that have coastlines a great deal of money to adapt to. And so that's part of one of the subtle points we try to get across. You know, there's time, but there's not a lot of time. And one of the things that complicates this is there are many possible solutions, too. And we could argue for the rest of this podcast over what the best mixture of solutions
sure.
are.
It sounds like it's a combination of things. I do think technology is moving very quickly, and I do think there's a place for government regulation. I think there's a place for both, you know.
But there's a part, you know, there's a place for both regulation and for market forces, because I am convinced that market-based remedies can be very, very useful in solving that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so much where the debate has gone wrong is that it's become an argument about the market versus government, which is not really the issue. The issue is global warming real? And then once we can agree upon that, then we can look at, okay, how do we solve that? What mixture of government and market forces do we use to regulate it?
I read it. Go on. I'm sorry, Eric.
That's where the whole doubt mongering thing comes in, because if we all acknowledge that it's a real problem, then we move on to the discussion of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the debate that we ought to be having in American society right now. But if you don't want a solution, because for whatever reason you are opposed to the solution or you like the status quo, then you can keep people from moving on to that conversation by raising doubts about the science. And that's what we've seen happen for the last 20 years on the question of climate change. So even though scientists have known for a long time that this problem is real, just like the tobacco industry knew that tobacco killed people, we can't get to the solution because so many of us have been persuaded by the doubt-mongering campaigns that the science is still unsettled.
Well
exactly.
having said that, though, you know, and it's so funny because you're citing these articles in the Wall Street Journal, many of which I had actually read, and there was a recent article I read in the Wall Street Journal about how that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change which is really the leading authority on climate change, that is, I guess, UN commissioned or whatever. They basically came out and said that global temperatures, surface temperatures, have remained flat for the past 15 years. Did you read that article? I don't know if you did.
Yeah. Eric, do you want to take that one?
Sure. That's a classic example of cherry picking, because what they, if you start your 15-year period at 1998, then it looks like you have a flat surface temperature line. But if you start it in 1996, well, you actually have an increasing temperature. And what wound up happening was the governments of the world forced the IPCC to deal with this claim from the climate skeptics. But the reality is, if you look at, on the other hand, ocean temperatures, they've continued to rise pretty much as expected, just as ice mass loss has continued and so on.
Wow.
So this whole idea of a global warming pause is a skeptic claim that doesn't hold up if you look seriously at the evidence. But because the IPCC must respond to government's questions, it had to deal with that issue.
What about the idea that the polar ice cap on one side is growing and the other side is shrinking? Heard that too.
Same thing. I'll take that one. I mean, so it's the same thing. And, you know, I did read the Wall Street Journal article and then also this one about the ice caps. It just shows that despite what some people claim, the doubt mongering is continuing. So we know that the Arctic ice is melting at an alarming rate. And any claims to the contrary, again, are just based on cherry picking data, taking individual years or individual seasons completely out of context. And of course, much of the data we have on the Arctic ice comes from the U.S. Navy, who's been measuring the extent and the thickness of Arctic ice since the 1950s. So any claim that that data is, you know, environmentalist hysteria, that's pretty not plausible. But again, here's where it all gets confused and conflated. You talked about the ice cap getting bigger on one side and smaller on the other. That's about Antarctica. And scientists have known for a long time that Antarctica is different than, you know, the South Pole is different than the North Pole, because of something called the circumantarctic current. And it's been known for a long time that global climate change could actually lead to increased ice on the east side of Antarctica, but to very serious ice loss on the west side. So this is where the science is legitimately complicated, and people, doubt mongers, skeptics, take that complication and use it to try to create confusion. The reality is that total amount of ice on the planet is decreasing rapidly. Virtually all continental glaciers are shrinking. The North Polar ice is shrinking. The Greenland ice sheet is melting. And probably most worrisome of all is the West Antarctic ice sheet, which if it were to break up rapidly, would lead to very, very major dramatic sea level rise of, you know, many meters.
It's really scary.
Scary things, right. Yeah. It's very serious and it's scary.
But I feel as though there is momentum in the world. I mean, I travel a lot and hotels are always telling you not to use as much water. And I feel as though and maybe I'm naive, but I do feel like regardless of these skeptics, there does seem to be momentum on the conservation side. Most people, are, at least in Europe and in this country increasingly, seem to be at least aware that they shouldn't be as wasteful, that these resources are finite, that there could very well be something called global warming, and we better act before it's too late. Do you feel that, or am I being overly optimistic?
I think that's true, and in general, you know, on my good days, I feel that way as well.
Yeah.
And no question, I think that people are aware. I think you're absolutely right about that. I think the problem is twofold. It's one thing to be aware, but it's another thing to really make a serious change. So, you know, you could let your towel not be washed every day in your hotel, and that's great. You
know? Yeah.
But it's not going to solve this problem. There's kind of a gap. There's a really, really big gap between the level on which you're talking, like not changing your towel every day, and the scale of the transformation of our energy system that needs to occur. And that, I think, is really the crux of the problem, because we're not talking about a modest change in the way we generate energy, the way we use energy. We're talking about a really substantial change to the entire energy infrastructure that warms our houses and lights our houses and runs our cars and our factory and our manufacturing and our travel. I mean, everything we do depends upon energy. And in the United States, virtually all of the energy we use comes from fossil fuels, with, you know, modest exceptions, a bit of nuclear.
Well, you know who to, you know who's to blame for all that? A lady named Jane Fonda. Okay? because you know what I mean? Listen, Jane, I hope she's listening to this podcast.
Hanoi Hannah.
Yeah, Hanoi Hannah.
No, look, the reality is that the loans for nuclear power plants were being canceled before Three Mile Island and before that movie came out. Because one of the things that everyone forgets about is that we had these Arab oil embargoes. At the time, most U.S. energy electricity production was actually from oil. And one of the reasons for the rationing schemes they implemented was so that the oil could continue going to the power plants and not into our cars. But once the Arab oil crisis came in, we had Jimmy Carter's rules and so on about how to respond to them. The fact is, electricity consumption went from growing at 7% a year to nothing percent a year, and it stayed there.
Wow.
And no one builds multi-billion-dollar nuclear power plants into a flat market. Mm-hmm. So the banks started canceling all the loans, and there were very few nuclear power plants left under construction when Three Mile Island happened because of that problem.
Wow.
It's all a matter of economics, and there's not another power plant built in the United States except for, what was it, Seabrook, and there's one other in nuclear power plant. And not even coal and gas plants. What winds up happening in the 80s is a massive repowering when all those oil plants get converted to coal, because coal's then cheaper and, of course, a lot safer from a geopolitics standpoint because it's all domestic.
So are you saying that global warming is not Jane Fonda's fault?
Nope.
Well, is the answer then more nuclear power plants? Is that the answer, Naomi? Is that what you're talking about, drastic action?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think I'm not anti-nuclear. I think there's a place for nuclear power in the energy portfolio. But as Eric says, nuclear power is incredibly expensive. It's a very, very expensive and very elaborate way to boil water. And it's never been economically feasible in the United States without massive government subsidies.
Really?
In fact, it actually hasn't been feasible anywhere without government subsidies. In fact, to me, one of the ironies of nuclear power, many people in the United States who are advocates of the free market or free market solutions are also pro-nuclear. But if you think about it, if you ask yourself, what is the only country in the world that has generated a large proportion of its electricity from nuclear power,
France,
and done so safely and done so with the support of its people? Do you know what the answer to that is?
France.
France. And how
70% nuclear power.
Wow.
Actually, I think it's closer to 80. But how did it do it? It did it in a nationalized industry.
the outrage.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think you can make nuclear power work if you are prepared to have it as a nationalized industry in a country like France that respects its elites. But whether or not that's a model for us in the United States, I think, is a very complicated question.
So what do we do?
Well, so, I mean, my own view is that we need a diversified energy portfolio that has to move us away from fossil fuels towards non-carbon-based fuels, which means mostly renewables, probably some nuclear, natural gas under certain circumstances, but that has to be phased out in the long run as well. And there's no way to get there from here, in my opinion, without some kind of appropriate government response. And whether that's a carbon tax or emissions trading system, we could argue about it. But the bottom line is that oil and gas is too cheap. And it's too cheap because we don't pay the true cost of it, because we don't pay the social cost.
Well, that's a very good point for free market people. We're not paying the true cost, and you bring that up in the book very well, I think, and that's exactly right. I have always liked the idea of a carbon tax, in that if you're using carbon, then you should pay for the carbon. I mean, that's kind of how that seems to be fair. If you drive 200 miles, and I know people would say, you know, it's going to stifle the economy, and they're very economists can have that argument all day. But the fact of the matter is, I think you're right when, you know, and you bring this up in the book and talk about it in detail. There is a price for using carbon. There is a dollar on there, and we're actually not paying. It's being subsidized. We're not paying the real price. I mean, that's the fact, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, Eric.
Right.
Eric.
Oh no, I'm just agreeing, because I mean there are many costs. There's the environmental costs. There are the military costs for protecting oil fields, And those things are not, we consumers pay them indirectly, so we don't realize that there are costs of carbon. And that's why we term it a market externality, and it needs to be roped into the market system so people pay the price directly.
Right. So if we pay the true cost of carbon, then a lot of this problem would be solved, because then the marketplace would respond, because then there'd be a strong incentive for entrepreneurs and large corporations to start providing cheaper alternatives. So it could happen, but it needs that prod. It needs that remedy for the market failure.
Well, I always get a kick out of these free market, these people who talk about free markets, these corporate guys who, of course, are the first guys with their hands out when their bank ends up making some bad decisions and they need to be bailed out, but they call Obama a socialist. Interesting. You know, it's the same idea. You know, if you're really a free market person, then start playing in the real free market, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And face, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, and also the truth, because, you know, one of the things that Eric pointed out early on, which I thought was maybe the most important thing of all, you know, if you read Adam Smith, one of the things he says is that for the marketplace to work, people have to have good information. Mm-hmm. And so one of the deep ironies about all the doubt mongering and all the disinformation that's been spread about these issues is that it's denying us the information we need to make appropriate choices in the marketplace. So we have bad information, and we have bad price signals, and we have perverse incentives. The World Bank estimates that global subsidies to the fossil fuel industry are $700 billion every year. So just remove that subsidy alone, and you would already take a really big step in the direction where we need to go.
I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time. I'm in education, and I've spent a lot of time around people who deny evolution at Christian schools. And the amazing thing is, because you really see it with kids, doubt is really easy to sell. You know, it doesn't require a lot of imagination to sell doubt, whereas the truth is inevitably much more complex. The explanation takes a little bit of time. You have to drag out facts and statistics. You have to have an underlying understanding to be able to make sense of the data. I mean, do you really think that over time this will resolve? Do you think it will resolve because people understand it, or just because people get on board with what the crowd believes?
Well, that's a really complicated question. I think, you know, the first part of what you said is really important. It partly explains why doubt mongering is so effective. It is really, really easy. All you have to do is plant the seed of doubt. And it's easy, and it's also lazy, because as you say, education is work. It takes time and energy, and especially to understand science. I mean, all of us, even those of us who like science, suffered through something that was really hard, quantum mechanics or thermodynamics or integral calculus, whatever it was. It's not easy, whereas doubt is really easy. And in fact, you can feel superior. You can say, oh, I don't believe all those scientists, and act as if somehow you're smarter than all these, you know, PhD geeks, right?
So
it's a kind of lazy man's out, but it's very attractive, especially if it fits with your worldview anyway. So how do we get out of that? Well, that's, of course, a huge question. And you'll notice that Eric and I carefully avoided that in the book.
Well, I understand, though. That's understandable. These are very complicated. These are huge issues, but...
There is, you know, if we wanted to write another book, or if we ever get around to writing another book, you know, there is one answer, which is leadership, that part of the reason so many people in the United States don't believe in evolution or don't accept the scientific evidence of climate change is because their political and religious leaders have told them not to. And that's incredibly damaging. And at least in the climate change, we've seen that from people who really ought to know better. People who we know, in fact, do know better. And so that's, to me, you know, there's some fingers to be pointed there, I think.
Well, and you do a great job of naming the culprits, but, you know, I will say that I think in this country, and it may take 50 years like it did with tobacco, but I do think that ultimately science seems to win the day. The worry, of course, is that it'll win the day when it's too late, when it comes to something like global warming, of course. But it does feel like the examples you cited beforehand, acid rain, certainly cigarettes. I don't know as much about ozone, but these... At the end of the day, legislation was passed. There was a 50% reduction in sulfur, nitric, whatever it is.
Sulfur dioxide.
Oh, right. Whatever. Sulfur dioxide. Details. Details. But there was, and it took some time. So that gives me pause. That gives me, you know, cause for hope, you know.
Eric and I always said that there's there's two readings of our book. There's an optimistic reading and a pessimistic reading. So the optimistic reading is the one you just gave, that in all these other instances, in the end, people did get the truth and we did act on it. And we did actually, if we didn't solve the problem completely, we went a long way towards making it much less worse. The pessimistic reading is that in the case of tobacco, it took 50 years. Yeah. And in the case of global warming, I don't really believe we have 50 years left to avoid damaging climate change.
Well, you know, your book goes a long way in helping that. You know, people like you, you know, that effort is, you know, it's so important. It's why I was so excited to get you on, and I've been talking up about the book so much. I think it's very, very important. Thank God for people like you guys. Did you go? We had Matt Ridley, who wrote The Rational Optimist, on the podcast a while back. Did either one of you guys read that book?
No.
Yeah.
I didn't read the book, but I've read some of his articles. I know what his argument is.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's not a scientist, so we should always keep that in mind.
Well, no, he is a scientist. Ironically, he's a geneticist. He's a zoologist. That's what his PhD is.
Oh, I didn't know.
And so you have physicists talking about biology and biologists talking about physics and climate change.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah, where and let it be said right now that, you know, and you again talk about this, the scientists that are experts in climate change, the vast majority of them are all saying that global warming is not only a fact, but it is man-made, right?
Correct. Yep.
Just wanted to get that out there.
Yep.
Since we're solving all the problems on the Brian Callen Hunter Motz show, I have to whisper his name. He's below me. He's younger.
Well, and, you know, just to play devil's advocate here, I think that, you know, one of the – because essentially the problem that we're, you've talked about leadership, right? And part of that is also scientific leadership, right? How good is the scientific community at producing leaders? How good is it at producing...
Different skill set. Might be a different skill set.
Well, but that's the problem is that I don't know. Can we rely on there being scientists and then there being people who communicate that science? Because clearly there's a breakdown there.
Yeah.
Do you think that the scientific community needs to place more of an emphasis on leadership and communication, on, you know, better articulation? I mean, what are your thoughts, for example, on Al Gore? Do you think that Al Gore has helped the cause?
I don't like that guy.
Or not?
He's too weak in the neck. Keep going.
I agree. He's too big in the neck. I agree with that. Let's not talk about Al Gore. But
you know, it's true, by the way. You do need – the scientific community should just hire some dude with a thick mustache and like a flannel shirt with big forearms.
Dos Equis man,
yeah, the Dos Equis man. Or Brian Callen. I'll bulk up for it. I got to take some testosterone. I'll do it. My voice is too shrill, unfortunately. Damn it.
Yeah, but
that's exactly right. The scientific community doesn't advertise. They don't hire – you know, spokespeople, because they think that that's not appropriate. The scientific community believes that the facts will out and that the truth will win, and you just have to do your scientific work. And I think, you know, one of the lessons that I think Eric and I take from the work we've done is that it's just not enough.
Yeah.
You know, the science is necessary, but it's not sufficient. The scientific community hasn't really stepped up to the plate, and there is a gap, as, you know, Hunter said. And it's a problem because you don't want to advertise. You don't want to argue that the scientific community should do what the Dow mongers do and hire PR firms and advertising firms to misrepresent the truth. That would not be a good thing. And yet, clearly, the scientific community has to do something more than it's done. And that's a big question, how they can
do it. As you're talking, I'm thinking of Galileo, who I think was arrested for being a heretic and almost got burned at the stake, didn't he? I mean, and I think the same with Copernicus and several other, you know, great scientists. So it seems to me that the Middle Ages are alive and well in some ways in 2013, ladies and gentlemen.
We don't burn people at the stake, but we do steal their emails and subpoena their scientific records.
There you go.
But I mean, the point is that what you're really articulating here is that everybody has work to do, right? The scientists need to communicate, make a more of a priority to communicate. You know, the leaders have to be responsible for saying that what they are saying is actually the truth and is accountable to the best that we know, right? The citizens have to do more of a job to inform themselves. This is really going to have to be a collective effort in order to solve this problem. We can't just outsource it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of Obama and his, just in terms of being an environmentalist and what he's done? Oh boy. I like loaded questions. I love them. They're like, I can't answer that question right now.
Well, I'll take it if Eric doesn't want to. I was just trying to be nice and give Eric a chance if he wanted to step up.
Step on that landmine.
Eric's probably talking. He's probably calling from the White House.
I'll say what I think. I think it's incredibly disappointing that Obama has done so good on this issue. Now, admittedly, he's got, as we are seeing right now, an extremely recalcitrant Congress. But nevertheless, I think he could have done more. And I think, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece that was published in the Washington Post just around the time of the inauguration where I pointed out that, you know, the president has a lot of things he could do even without the support of Congress. And one thing he could do is he could mobilize the national laboratory system, because the national labs were created to address a national emergency, which was the fear of the Nazis building an atomic bomb. And we mobilized American scientists and American engineers and American machinists to build an atomic bomb and win World War II. And this isn't exactly an analogous situation. We're not in a war against climate change, but we are in a serious threat. And I think that Obama has not really conveyed to the American people the idea that this really is a threat to our livelihood, to our prosperity, to our health, to our security, both our national security and our physical security in our homes, really conveying to people why it matters, why this affects all of us. I don't think he has really done a very effective job at that. And that, to me, is very disappointing.
Well, you can blame.
So that leaves me with...
Go on, Eric.
Jane Fonda.
I guess that leaves me to defend what they've tried to do. One thing that I thought was very positive and I hope doesn't get completely destroyed by Congress was the idea of an advanced research project agency for energy, which is something like what Naomi recommended, but has not found quite the funding levels that I think it should have. And of course, they have issued regulations for new power plants, not yet for the older power plants, I don't think, that will also go a long way towards biasing the system away from coal anyway, though unfortunately it does so by reinforcing natural gas. And as Naomi implied earlier, we do actually have to get off all fossil fuels, not just coal.
But to really be able to create effective legislation, the first thing the president needs is consensus. And that's what this all comes back to is, you know, as long as there is doubt, nothing happens. Nothing is done.
Well, I think also your book does a good job of, I think I'm surprised the scientific community didn't mobilize and go after people like Singer and Seitz and the like. There were only four or five of them, man. You know, it's like that would have made me so furious when you think about the kinds of stuff that they, the tireless effort to debunk good science, and the vast majority of these great scientists that are doing this objective work. And nobody, man, I would have gone on the war path with a guy like this.
You have to remember something, Brian, is that, and not to tout ourselves too much, but before we did this work, most people in the scientific community did not realize what was going on. Most people in the scientific community were just doing their science in their laboratories, and they thought that if people didn't understand climate science, it was because they were scientifically illiterate, that they didn't have enough science education. Mm. And to the extent that the scientific community made any effort at all, it was an effort to explain the science more clearly. Mm-hmm. But when you're up against doubt mongering, explaining the science more clearly doesn't solve the problem.
So has your book had that kind of an effect? Have you give me the what's been the blowback from your book? From Singer? Did you hear from Singer and these guys? What's happened?
Well, the good part of it is we heard from a lot of scientists who said to us, "Oh my God, I had no idea that this was what was going on." Wow. And so there has been a shift in the scientific community. I think we have helped. I think our work has contributed to it. Of the scientific community saying, okay, we get it now. This isn't just scientific illiteracy. This isn't just a matter of speaking more clearly. We have to be more proactive. We have to counter disinformation in a more assertive way. And so you have seen organizations like the American Geophysical Union and the American Meteorological Society being much more proactive. The AGU has a rapid response team now that responds to disinformation and, you know, tries to clear it up. So I do think there have been shifts in the scientific community, and I do think our work has helped contribute.
That's got to be incredibly satisfying. I'm so that's so amazing, man. What a payoff, right?
Yeah, it is. And when we get scientists saying, "Oh my God, we didn't know," that is really great. You know,
That's just amazing, man. That's really what a how long did it take you to write this book?
Too long.
Well, it depends, I guess, on when you start, because we were both into researching climate science independently for a bunch of years before we met, even. So if you include all that, it's, you know, 6-7 years maybe.
Yeah.
Wow.
But from the time we actually met and started talking about a book, it's probably 4.
Yeah, about 5 years, Eric, I reckon, from when we met to when the book came out.
Give me your backgrounds, and Naomi, what is your background? What did you study, and what are your credentials, I guess?
I trained as a geologist. I worked as an exploration geologist for a mining company in South Australia, actually on uranium exploration.
Wow.
Then I went back to school and got a PhD in geology and history of science. So I have formal training in both earth science and history of science. And since the 1990s, I've mostly worked as a historian of science.
I love talking to really smart people. This is the greatest. I'm a comedian, man. I'm a stand-up comic. Eric, what about you?
Oh, boy. My undergraduate degree is a joint degree in geology and mechanical engineering. Then I was a Navy officer for a number of years before going to graduate school. Then I went to graduate school for history of science and technology. And mostly since then, I've worked in aerospace history and, of course, my sidelight in climate science, history of climate science.
Wow, man. It really is a privilege to talk to you guys. I wouldn't have anything to say. Like, you know, like at a dinner party, I just look at you guys and say, well, whatever, make me laugh, you know. And it's amazing. Your book taught me, I know, you know, Hunter was the one who said, dude, you got to read this book. And and I called my father, who is a global warmest denier. He calls other people warmists because he reads the Wall Street Journal. But the guy, we had a long talk the other day about it, and he's going to read the book. And but he, you know, he was a banker for a long time and a military guy himself, and one of these 1950s males, and just believes in the free market. And he's just anything when it comes to the government is basically evil. Jane Fonda is clearly the Antichrist, etc.
Well, we've debunked that on this.
Yes, and he is coming around. He's a guy who changes his mind, which is why I love him. So,
well, that's good. I say people love to think that Eric and I are like crazy, greeny environmentalists. So I love it when people ask us about our background, so you can tell them that, you know, Eric's an engineer who worked in the Navy, and I was a uranium geologist.
I love it. Yeah. I know. Yeah. I know. Well, no, listen, I got to tell you, your book, the other thing I really loved about it is you are so fair. You're so fair, man. You're so fair even to guys like Singer and Seitz. I mean, you describe what may have been going on in their heads. You're not calling them complete a-holes. I mean, you're looking at them as human beings who are complicated with their own agenda. I have my own conclusions on those guys.
But I think that's the thing. What I love about the book is that, you know, coming out of the climate of the 1950s, right, when you're looking at government regulation in terms of the Soviet Union, right? You could understand that you would be cagey about government regulation, but obviously you take it to these, you know, ridiculous extremes, and, you know, you've ended up creating a problem
on the other end of the spectrum. My father raised me, I'm not kidding, saying you're better dead than red, okay? And I remember really believing that. So, you know, but of course, things change and you get older. I don't want to be a comic, but I was going to ask you one more question about all this, but have you heard from the bad guys in this book?
Yeah, of course, but we try not to worry about it, and I really appreciate what you said about the book being fair, because we really tried hard to be fair, and we really were scrupulous about making sure that all the claims were documented. So obviously we didn't expect the protagonists of this story to like what we had to say about them, but we do think it was fair.
You kind of have to do that anyway, don't you? Because you can get sued for libel and stuff without having
all the sources. But it was also, that's true. But
I think we would have done it even if we didn't have to worry about libel and defamation.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Eric, go ahead.
What I was going to say is it was actually important to our argument that each of those gentlemen actually did something significant and important in his original scientific career.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, you know, in Nirenberg's case, he set up Scripps' climate science program, which is world class.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a matter, it certainly wasn't just a matter of worrying about the libel lawyers. It was a matter of that's how they became so influential. They had once done good, sound, important scientific work.
What do you think happened with Nierenberger? Did you just get seduced by the money, the limelight? What?
I will tell you. I mean, you know, I used to live at in Jim Watson's basement of Watson and Crick.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, it's for me, it's always been fascinating to contrast the careers of Francis Crick and James Watson. Because Francis Crick, you know, he won the Nobel and proceeded to attack problem after problem. You know, he figured out transcription. He figured out, you know, when he figured out that all of that work was done, he moved into neuroscience. He was always challenging himself. And on his deathbed, he was trying to solve a problem to do with consciousness and the brain and all that sort of stuff. So he really threw himself into his work. And, you know, there are certain scientists who instead decide to try and rest on their laurels. You know what I mean? They do their one thing and they think their work is done, and it poisons you, because if you're not constantly working and striving and struggling, it just becomes much easier to go for the low-hanging fruit of being famous.
That's for sure.
You know, and you see the same thing with actors as well.
Yeah, comedy. I mean, you got to keep writing. You develop a following, and, you know, you got to keep coming up with new jokes. You know, I'm just like a nuclear physicist, guys.
Come up with new jokes. I'd like to talk to you about that sometime.
Anytime you guys want to write a book about stand-up comedy, it is a world nobody really knows. follow me on the road just for a month. You'll have a lot, I promise.
Especially, Eric, what's the thing? That's a totally different angle we hadn't thought about before.
There you go. It's all about imagination, right? I mean, you know.
You don't have to really. I mean, that's one of the things that Brian always talks about is that, you know, stand-up comedy is so democratic, right? Okay. Like, either, you know, there's no doubt mongering. Nope. Nobody can doubt monger that joke funny or not.
You either laugh or you don't. Why I love watching fighting. A lot of my friends are fighters. I love it because you get in that ring, and if you're a UFC fighter or a boxer, no amount of hype or scientist is going to help you. You either knock the guy out or you get knocked out. You know, there's no lying. That's what I like about sports, in fact, you know. And unfortunately, the world is a lot more complicated, and you do such a good job in this book, The Merchants of Doubt. You know, I don't know, man. I think we all owe you. I consider it, and I haven't said this before, and we've talked to some people, I really do consider it a privilege to talk to you guys.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you guys are really, I don't know, you've done us a great service. What's your next book?
Go ahead.
I hope it's not about cell phones and how they cause brain cancer, because I'm going to freak out.
We're working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't formulated another joint book that we like yet.
Well, listen, man, everybody should read this book, and I'm going to talk to Joe Rogan about you guys. And I don't know if you know much about him, but his podcast reaches a lot of people, and I'm going to make it a personal mission to get as many people to read The Merchants of Doubt, Naomi Oreskes and Eric M. Conway joining us. Thank you so much, you guys. Really appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
It was
talking
great.
To you.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Go back to changing the world.
Yeah, and some good jokes. I need some new jokes for my talk.
Listen to me, Naomi. I'm going to be in Boston, I think, in December. And will you please come out to a show? I promise I'll make you laugh your ass off for an hour and 10 minutes.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Send me an email. Have Hunter send me an email. Tell me when and where, and I will totally be there.
I promise I'll have you on my list. And Eric, where are you? You're in Pasadena?
I live in Pasadena, yeah.
Whatever. Just come to the Laugh Factory when I'm there, for Christ's sake.
Oh, wonderful. Laugh Factory. Okay.
There it is. Actually, I go to the Ice House, too, a lot in Pasadena. What am I thinking? So I might.
Oh,
yeah.
Let you know. I'll let you know. Walk there.
There you go. Perfect. All right, man. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, guys.
Great time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
They're great. Those are the people that make a real difference in the world. They really make a difference, you know?
Absolutely. And I think what's so powerful is that they've really the issue that we need to solve is not global warming. The issue we need to solve is consensus on global warming.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Until we've
got to win the information battle.
That's right. And then once we've done that, then I mean, you know, humanity has the capacity to be able to solve that problem. We can change the way that we generate energy. We can do all of those things,
funny,
but we have to get agreement first.
But it's also funny how facts are not the end of the story.
Absolutely.
You know, you can present somebody with all the facts in the world. A lot of times people aren't even arguing over the facts. They're arguing over how they grew up, attitudes, their dad. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't actually know if he's dead or not, but there's a guy named Everett Rogers who wrote a really great book called The Diffusion of Innovations. And it's basically about why do ideas move? And he says that the most important thing is that people think that ideas move rationally. They don't. They move culturally. you know? And so that's the point, is that really what you're dealing with is two different cultures, and it's become an article of faith for both groups. You know, there are people who believe in global warming, and there are people who believe that global warming is fake, but very few of them have actually looked at the data.
Me, I'm guilty of that. I'm, a lot of
me
things.
Too.
We're as human beings. I mean, you know, if you ever ask somebody why they really like Obama, for example, or they really like, you know, Romney, but especially someone like Obama. Mm-hmm. I mean, I voted for the guy because I like the idea of voting for a black guy. I just like sending that message to the world, like, go fuck yourself. You guys think we're racist, you know? I did. I just, you know, and I think he's a sensible guy, and I think he's a fair-minded
guy. Did you picture a Frenchman as you cast your vote?
I did indeed. But I don't know. I don't. If you really had a debate about whether Obama is a good candidate for president, I would argue no. He hasn't left a legislative or academic legacy at all. He's been hopelessly neutral. I don't think he's been an effective leader. But
is that Obama, or is that the circumstances of,
I don't know,
you know, campaign finance and all that sort of
stuff?
Is
I don't
it
know.
Possible to elect a good leader anymore?
That's a very good question. And then again, those are the debates.
Absolutely.
But in order to have an intelligent debate, you've got to read books like So Damn
Absolutely.
Much Money, Republic Lost. You've got to read Merchants of Doubt. You've got to read, like, the China study does a very good job, by the way, of describing how scientists like who were hired by Kraft and Nestle hijacked the free lunch program and things. There's a lot mm-hmm. of money to getting their products into schools
Absolutely.
And prisons and things like that.
It's a captive market.
Yeah, 25% of your diet can be made of simple sugars, guys. No worries. Don't worry.
Well,
that.
And ketchup is a vegetable, right?
Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. So the struggle continues, and it's solved, and it's and the tip of the spear is the Brian Callen Hunter Monster Show. And don't you fucking forget it. All right. Peace!
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter @BrianCallen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/BrianCallenComedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.